The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here.
Now, you may have thought that we had sort of given up on our Donald Trump obsession on this programme, that we decided after he left office in late January that that was enough. We didn't really want to be dealing with him anymore. And even I just managed to stop reading all of the Donald Trump books that there were there to read, except I broke my vow over the weekend and had the opportunity to read a terrific book about the last days of Donald Trump in office. Michael Wolff is back again. You might remember Fire and Fury, which was the original and possibly still the best of the Trump books. Well, Michael has written Landslide, and I'm delighted to say he joins us on The Last Word today. Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Really glad to be here.
Now, the first place I want you to start is actually in the epilogue of the book, if you wouldn't mind, because I love the description you have of where Donald Trump is now in Mar-a-Lago and how he holds court there, effectively in the lobby. Tell us all about what people can see there, please.
Well, the first thing perhaps to say is how weird it is that I got an invitation to Mar-a-Lago. The last time, I've written two prior books, which have been, to say the least, unflattering to Donald Trump, and he threatened to sue me, tried to stop the publication, announced I was a loser, this, that, the other thing. But nevertheless, when he heard that I was writing this third book, he invited me to come down to Mar-a-Lago to talk to him. And of course, I went. And what I found there, it's really quite extraordinary. For one thing, to truly appreciate this, you have to understand that Donald Trump lives in the middle of a country club. I mean, he's the only one who lives there, but it's an old-fashioned country club. There are big poster boards saying, prime rib night Thursdays or Italian night with accordion player or my favorite Asian night. A lot of retired men and women in resort clothing of colors that you never imagine existed in nature. And there is Donald Trump in the middle of this, and he conducts all his business there, and he doesn't do it in an office. He does it in the middle of the lobby. So he is sitting there in this rather strange lobby room with all kinds of conflicting motifs, kind of hunting lodge, Renaissance palazzo. You get the picture, kind of Rococo church, weird beyond weird.
In addition to that, you also wrote about how when he goes and dines in the restaurant each evening and himself and Melania come in, everyone stands and applauds him in, which seems utterly bizarre as well.
Totally. They wait until the restaurant fills up and then they walk in like they're a bride and groom, and everybody stands up and applauds. And then they sit at a table which is right in the middle of all these tables, but it has a red rope around it. And everyone kind of gawks at them, or in wedding fashion comes up and they spend their entire dinner kind of greeting people.
Do they slip him envelopes with cash as well?
Well, we can only imagine.
Indeed. But does he have so much self-belief that he thinks he can bend anyone else to think as he does? Is that the reason that he brought you down for interview, that he could hope to sway you in the way you would write up the book to be a description of what he believes to be the truth?
I suppose that's part of it, but it's wrong to credit Donald Trump with too much strategy and too clear a plan. Part of me thinks it just literally doesn't matter who he's talking to, and anyone who is willing to listen to him, even if it's his worst enemy, which might be me, that's good enough for Donald Trump. He just wants to talk.
That comes across so much in the book, Michael, that the man never shuts up. Does he ever listen to anybody?
Never. I mean, this is one of the key issues of the last 4 years of the Trump presidency. Is that no one can really communicate with him because he literally does not listen. In addition to that, he doesn't read either. So how do you get any information to this man who is just constantly motor mouthing? Constantly, it's a constant stream of conversation which is not related to anything anyone else says. This is not a give and take. This is not a discourse. This is just a kind of nonstop blather.
But where does he get the facts from? And I say facts almost in inverted commas, that he constantly regurgitates, particularly as you document in the book, are these long monologues about how he believes the election was stolen from him. And in every part of the United States of America, he seems to have stats on the votes that were denied to him or were wrongly counted.
Well, yeah, but let's not make the mistake to think that these are actual stats, that he has somehow collected evidence here. He has kind of cherry-picked things that he hears, and just because he hears things does not mean that he is actually repeating what he has heard. It kind of comes into his head and then comes out the way he wants it to come out. So whatever he's talking about, and especially related to this election challenge, really has no bearing in reality, no bearing in numbers, no bearing in anything that remotely adds up to a picture which involves credibility, logic, evidence, and any of those and any of the empirical truths that most other people would want to have at their disposal if they're arguing such an issue that an election has been stolen from them.
Michael, the monologue that he delivers that you have in the epilogue is actually very, very funny in some respects as to how delusional he almost is about what has actually happened. But I also got the sense throughout the book that he really believes the election was stolen from him, that he has convinced himself utterly of that.
Utterly. Absolutely. And it's a very kind of, I think, important note here. And, because most of the media coverage about these many weeks after the election was about, this evil man trying to exert his will to take back an election, essentially to steal an election back. I don't put me in the position, of course, of defending Donald Trump. But nevertheless, I will say that this man believed all this. Nobody else believed it. Literally, nobody in none of his aides in the White House, none of the people who worked on his campaign, nobody in his family believed it. But Donald Trump singularly, along with Rudy Giuliani, which is another alarming point here, came to believe that this election was stolen from him. So what we have is not necessarily a man trying to undermine democracy, a man, a potential despot and dictator. What we have is just a man who is absolutely delusional.
Because it strikes me that he didn't want to have power to exercise it for any particular reason. It just comes across that the important thing to him was to be the man, to be the president, to be the one that everyone loved. But it wasn't so that he could do anything with the power, or was it?
Yeah, no. I mean, he doesn't have any interest. I mean, begin with, he doesn't have any interest in politics. He doesn't have any interest in policy. He doesn't have any interest in management. He doesn't have any interest in government. All of those things are a big burden and a bother to him. And he knows so little about this stuff that it just washes around him. But what he does want to be is the man at the center of attention. That is his need and his goal and the thing that the thing that sustains him.
Does he ever experience doubt, though, or has he reached the stage where reality to him is whatever he wants it to be for himself?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the latter. I mean, he lives in this bubble, a bubble that he fully controls, that he fully imagines. And it's a bubble in which there's only one person, and occasionally Rudy Giuliani. And it is whatever he wants it to be.
It's quite extraordinary. But tell us about the enablers. Tell us about the people who hang around him all the time, hang off him, allow him to do all this. Why do they actually do it? Seeing as he doesn't seem to pay any bills, so it's not like he's necessarily paying them for that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a curious thing. You know, there is a staff in the White House, people who run the campaign, and you know, you can certainly fault them, and probably should fault them, for being willing to work for Donald Trump. But these are still largely political professionals, maybe not the top of the class, but they're all reasonable people. And so, you know, you have to ask the question, OK, why? And I don't really have an answer, except that, you know, he did become the president of the United States. And this is a kind of perceptual this mind-boggling thing. How do you you need to, it's a democracy, he's the president, you're a good Republican, you're making your career in politics, you work for him. Now, but that doesn't mean that you don't find him to be the weirdest person you have ever met in your life. It doesn't mean that you don't find every interaction with him peculiar and disturbing. It doesn't mean that that you don't go home at night and shake your head and pull the covers over your head. And it doesn't mean ultimately that you don't talk to journalists and say, journalists like me, and try to somehow describe the strangest experience that you've ever had. And yet, of course, at the same time, you are enabling him. You enable him by just standing there and listening to this man. Still, and I must say, and it's a measure of how extreme this post-election situation was, all of these people finally deserted him. They ran as fast as they could to get out from there. This is the people in the White House, the people in the campaign, even the people in his family, because they all knew, A, he had lost the election, B, whatever he was doing was not going to change that outcome. And then that left this vacuum, a vacuum in which people like Rudy Giuliani came right in.
And I'm glad you brought him up again, because he was my next question before we get to Mike Pence. If everybody reckoned that Rudy Giuliani was a busted flush, and clearly at times Trump understood and knew that as well, why then did he continue to rely so heavily on him and believe that somehow that Giuliani was right in saying that on January the 6th, Mike Pence would not actually allow for the votes to be registered and counted?
You know, I think it's very basic. I mean, Trump shops for what he wants to hear. And if at the end of the day, only Rudy Giuliani, who Trump acknowledges is a drunk, maybe on the verge of senility, but if he is the only one who is saying what Trump wants to hear, then he's the chosen man. Then he's the president's personal lawyer.
And then Vice President Mike Pence. Did Trump regard him as such a lapdog that he would do anything for him?
Yes. I mean, I think that was the basic assumption about Mike Pence, that he would... that his loyalty was certainly a given, and you know, I mean, I think that was almost a kind of a fair assumption. And so again, it just goes to show how extreme this post-election situation was, that at the uh, that the, at the appointed moment, even Mike Pence deserted the president.
Do you get from your interviews any sense of regret from Pence and from his people that they never stood up to Trump until the very last moment?
Yes. I don't get a sense that they saw another alternative. You know, again, Donald Trump was the president of the United States. And, you know, for a political set in Washington around the president in the Republican Party, true conservative wing of the party that Mike Pence represented, Donald Trump, in a way, was good news. I mean, he was good news because he didn't care about this. He essentially made the conservative agenda, especially appointing conservative judges, possible. So all of these people, including the Pence people, entered into a devil's bargain, understanding without question that the president of the United States was a nutcase, a lunatic, off his rocker, but so uninterested in politics and policy that they could get what they wanted. He would never really interfere in what the conservatives wanted. So they had made they made their particular bed.
Indeed, and I'm fascinated by the Mitch McConnell detail as well in the book. So you've written Fire and Fury, you've written Siege, this is Landslide. Do you anticipate there'll be a fourth book about the Trump comeback?
I seriously pray to God not. I think this is the end. Well, at least it's the end for me. And we can only hope it's the end for Donald Trump.
Michael Wolff, thank you very much for joining us here on The Last Word of Today FM. It is a rollicking good read. It's Landslide.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today.